Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today I'm joined by my colleague Kareem Muhammad, who is the author of The Fight for Black Empowerment in the United States, or the USA, America's Last Hope. This is part of Routledge's Research in Race and Ethnicity series and is published by Routledge Press in 2024. So it is a very, very new book. And I'd like to welcome Kareem Muhammad to the podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to the book, The Fight for Black Empowerment in the USA. Hello, Kareem.
Hey, Dr. Gordon, or would you prefer me to call you Lily?
Lily's fine.
Well, thanks for having me today, Lily. I'm the Dean of Arts and Sciences here at Keele University. My background is actually in sociology, and much of my work is focused on race and cultural studies, particularly hip-hop culture. Within that, there's always been some political slants in all of my work, as I think, we talked about this previously, how culture and the political are very interlocked. But this was definitely a step in a new direction in terms of really digging into the former political system.
And you do dig into the political system in the United States, and you do it in a really kind of, fundamentally kind of political science-y way, if I'm using those terms correctly. Political science-y, of course, is a technical term there. And you are sort of getting at this question of, the who gets what, how, when, and why questions, which is, sort of basic questions about like political power, the distribution of goods from the government or elsewhere. So it is about, sort of power and dynamics, but it's also about the economics. You're starting out this project, which is this question of Black empowerment in the United States. And this is a group of people who have been systematically disenfranchised, mm-hmm. dislocated, obviously enslaved for a number of centuries in the United States. So when we're talking about Black empowerment, we're not just talking about also political empowerment. So can you talk a little bit about, sort of the fundamental thesis that you're working on here in terms of like the sociological and political science overlays?
Absolutely. I'll double back in terms of kind of what was the impetus for this work, in the first place. In talking to some of my friends and colleagues, and increasingly in the Black community, there is like just kind of a denial of our power in some cases where, and this dates back even to the election of President Obama, where folks, some felt like, okay, well, this is just something that's symbolic. It is not a true reflection of any kind of like Black improvement or Black empowerment. A point that I take a strong opposition to. So to your point, really, I really wanted to look at how power is distributed, where I think the poli sci folks are understanding as well that power is not something that's absolute within a social system. And a lot of times, and speaking to some of my colleagues, again, these are by and large, middle class, upper middle class folks with high levels of education, who just felt, you know, powerless, that the Black community is powerless. So I really wanted to disturb that notion. But not with anything that's, you know, anecdotal, but to just provide as much empirical evidence as possible to demonstrate how power has been demonstrated, how power has been distributed across time. And across time is an important component of it, because as you know, democracy and political change can move. It can seem very slow, and I understand that frustration. But I want, but when looking at the broad scope of things, the strides that Black Americans have made in this country, to your point in being slaves less than 200 years ago, I think is amazing when you look at it in a global perspective and sizing up political systems more broadly. So we still have a long ways to go, no question. But the impetus for it was to kind of a love story to the Black community first and foremost, although that's not the only audience by any means, but to really like challenge us to think about power a little bit more differently, a little bit differently, and to really recognize and appreciate some of the gains that have been made. And then finally, to recognize, because Mitt Romney, for example, in the 2012 election, he had made the comment, I think this was when the waiter had recorded him at the fundraising event, that essentially was saying that, you know, President Obama gets people to vote for him because, you know, of, you know, he's giving things away. And there are some within a Black community and definitely outside of it in conservative circles, most particularly, that also have bought into this notion. And a book really challenges readers to move away from this because nothing has been given. Every single like morsel of power that's been gained within a Black community has been fought for, and each generation has to start to fight anew. A lot of times we think that, like, okay, that since Medgar Evers and Martin Luther King and Fannie Lou Hamer and Barbara Montgomery, you know, had certain fights back in the 1950s and 60s, that the work is done. So it just really challenged our readers to understand that power is an ongoing fight. It is not an absolute variable. It is something that is fluid throughout society. And to try and help us to leverage our power more effectively. I hope that answered your questions.
It did. And again, you're talking about this idea, this concept of Black empowerment, right? And Black empowerment is exactly that. It's the idea that this particular community that has unfortunately suffered at the hands of so much in the United States, not just enslavement, but ridiculous prejudice and Jim Crow, and, you know, sort of undermining of the capacity of this particular racial group to succeed in the American dream, right? That there is in fact power in this coalition. And it's not something that should be either taken for granted or kind of written off. So can you talk about how, you know, politics and political parties in general, but the sort of democracy in the United States has kind of written off Black empowerment?
A great question. Historically, so the skepticism and in some cases downright cynicism that some of my colleagues felt like is coming from a very real place, because there have been moments throughout history where the Black vote has not been considered. And in many ways, Lily, I attempt to like even expand this discussion beyond voting, because too often when we think of politics, we only think about in these 4-year blocks in terms of presidential elections, and that politics only plays out at the voting booth. And as you know, as I'm sure you know better than most, everything is political, just about in our everyday lives. So to really try and like, you know, refocus this shift in terms of at different points in history, this has not always been true in terms of the Black political bloc having a lot of leverage and power. There have been times in history just because we, you know, it's, our system is one that works from a political majority as opposed to a parliamentary system. There have been moments in some places where the Black vote can almost be ignored. This happens in some states, some cities still today. but there have been particular moments in history, Reconstruction, the New Deal, the late 60s, and I think now, where the Black vote has been very decisive. The white vote is so evenly divided right now in ways that I sometimes find strange, but it is, well, actually, I take that back. I don't find it strange, and I imagine we'll speak to that in a moment. But this is a moment right now where the Black vote, and this bore out in 2016 and 2020, and even in the midterms to a degree, it's been really decisive. So one of the things, for example, you know, speaking to your question directly, Lily, it frustrates me. We hear about these different voting blocks. So we'll hear that, you know, we need to appeal to Midwestern voters. And a lot of times that's a standstill for we need to get some white working class union voters, a group of voters that have showed the Democratic Party since the 1980s that they're just not into them. But election after election after election, the Democrats in particular on a national level, they are very aggressive in their overtures to this group in ways that is not always seen within a Black community. And that is just a politically negligent strategy in my view. And this is shown out. So in 2016, for example, the election wasn't lost in, like, you know, some of these white working class enclaves. It was lost by not turning out Milwaukee and not turning out Detroit and not turning out Atlanta and not turning out Philadelphia. So these are the pockets where I think, you know, there's an old saying, you got to dance with who brought you. And a lot of times, you know, I think the Democratic Party has kind of tried to shy away from its identity and try and be everything to all people in a way that, to their credit, the Republican Party over the last 30, 40 years has not done as much. So I think that hopefully, and I do see some positive signs in this direction, that the Democrats are understanding that their path to political victory is lies in expanding their base. And I speak specifically to the Black community for the most part in this book, but by no means is that the only focus. They have to, increase their share of the Latino vote. They have to work hard to get more young voters. They have to energize, our brothers and sisters in the LGBTQ community. So this coalition of the ascended, if you will, I think are the folks that really need to be drawn out. But my argument here, Lily, is that if they don't, get Black a high level Black voter turnout, election success is almost impossible.
All right. And following up on the sort of this discussion of, you know, the various groups that make up the Democratic Party coalition, part of what you're talking about in this book in particular is the way that Black Americans have been, you know, real bedrocks of the Democratic Party, particularly New Deal on. And so obviously there has been critique over the years that the Democratic Party takes this voting bloc for granted. And of course, the particularly African-American women turn out at about the highest levels of any particular group in the United States consistently. And so, unfortunately, Democrats do take them for granted. But you're also talking about the fact that within this voting bloc of Black voters, that women and men are having a little bit of a sort of cleavage. Can you talk about not only this question of taking this group of voters for granted, but also what's going on there?
No, great question. I'm glad you spoke to that, because you're right. Like, in talking about the Black voting bloc, in many ways, a misnomer. And Lily, like, quite frankly, maybe dating back at least 200 years, quite frankly, like, so even the civil rights movement, you hear about Martin Luther King and, you know, and John Lewis and Ralph Abernathy, and they're like, you know, and great dudes who did amazing work. The civil rights movement was led and spurred by Black women. And that's been the political leadership in our communities for quite some time. And one of the things in the lead up to this book that really became alarming to me is that the book makes an attempt to really challenge the vestiges of white supremacy, which, you know, while not as I was going to say as not as overt as the Reconstruction period, but each day I kind of wonder Right. Like we're getting, we might be nudging back to that. But one of the things that
alas,
like,
yes. Alas, right. Yes.
Right. One of the things that really struck me, particularly in some of my anecdotal conversations, is that how much so many Black men are deeply invested in the idea of white supremacy patriarchy, which just, and I guess I should not have been so taken aback by this, but it's been really alarming, in some cases disturbing and heartbreaking, where I think in, you know, a sizable segment of Black men have found, like, you know, Trump's fake machismo very appealing. And in terms of, like, you know, making America great again, that also might mean that, you know, where men could be men and women would, quote unquote, know their place. And there are a lot of Black men today who find that really appealing. And again, some of it, I think, much like the Black and white working class have often been pitted against each other historically, I think we see some of those divides here as well. But even as more groups begin to make inroads, like there's a huge, a sizable homophobic stream within the Black male community, unfortunately. And a lot of times, you know, and again, it took me off guard because I thought, hey, we were all for equality. But increasingly, like, people are like, no, we're for Black equality. And everybody else will just have to kind of figure it out. But, you know, you can't have one without the other. Like, if we're going to attack white supremacy, we have to, like, you know, attack it all. And there are some Black men, I think, for example, we see this most visibly with, you know, my fellow Chicagoan, Kanye West, for example, and in some of his public postures and fascination with Hitler and stuff like that, like we're seeing with, you know, the likely Republican nominee. And it just seems to be really strange. But to your point, this has been kind of festering for a while. I think that there are some Black men who feel uncomfortable with the amount of power and influence that Black women are gaining. And again, even at that stage, like, you know, we still have a long ways to go. But that divide has been particularly disturbing. And Democratic politicians have to find a way to communicate in a way to try and bridge those cleavages that you spoke about. But they're very real and they're very pronounced. And then one final point related to this is it's also socioeconomic in that much like we see with suburban white voters, for example, and there's a difference in terms of like how many of the white working class, you know, lean politically. I think we're seeing this in, as well within the Black community because Black women have been able to, like, you know, reap the benefits of formal education and upward mobility at rates that are higher than Black men. There are a lot of systemic reasons for this, particularly the, you know, predatory war on drugs that was launched through Nixon, Reagan, and even Bill Clinton that really did a number on a lot of Black males within a community. But I think that as opposed to looking at the culprit of these problems, a lot of times Black women are held as scapegoats in that regard.
And I know that you talk about some of these statistics in the book, and I've also seen them elsewhere with regard to the much higher level of education that Black women have been attaining over time, and that Black men, also like white men, have been falling behind or choosing not to pursue. And so therefore they have also not entered into a sort of professionalized class. And I'm not trying to make big giant, you know, sort of sweeping generalizations here. But there are these sort of, you know, sort of distinctions in both the white community and the Black community in terms of who's going to college, who's succeeding in college, and, you know, who's achieving, you know, different kinds of job outcomes, which stands a lot of the sort of idea of what happened for the African-American family kind of on its head from the, you know, sort of from the New Deal period into in manufacturing and the and industrial sort of jumps that we went through in the post-war period, that the Black man was the head of the household. And you talk about this in the book. Can you talk just a little bit more about, you know, how this is also starting to impact the political dynamics with regard to Black empowerment?
No, great question. The book actually, like, so the book actually begins with this, this kind of balance, like, with my own household and as a child, like, you know, kind of seeing, like, you know, the gender, because, like, overtly, Lily, like, it might have, like, the traditional patriarchal model. And let me be clear, like, you know, and as I'm sure you know, Black feminism is often framed in a different way than, like, you know, traditional feminism would be. You know, so there are some nuances there, but overtly, like, okay, well, the man is the head of the household. But historically, Lily, like, the women run the household. Like, so again, it might look like my father is, like, you know, controlling this or that. Like, my mother chooses what power to give him and allow him to have. That's true. You know, so Dad, if you hear this and you know this, like, that's still true here today in 2023. My mama runs things. And this is true in almost every Black household I'm familiar with. But I think that it trickling into the economic, that divide, particularly where the marriage rate over the past generations has decreased. Again, the rate of incarceration can be overstated in terms of this capacity. But I think the family structure definitely has an impact upon how these are playing out in our politics. And but I think that a lot of Black men who take this posture, much like, again, with the white working class that have this nostalgic view of what America was, I think amongst many Black males, it's overstated in that regard as well. Women have long been the matriarchs of our communities and the leaders of our communities in many ways for a very long time, in a way that I think gets lost in some of today's political discussion. And then just in terms of power, Lily, like, again, as a political scientist, you know this better than others. We look at our politics too often as a zero-sum game. So we look at it as, if the Black woman is making some of these gains, it's at the expense of me as a Black man, which is totally incorrect. And this has been borne out empirically. But we need to message this a little bit better and more effectively, you know, both within our community and, you know, outside of it.
Yeah, I mean, because this is also obviously the narrative in the sort of white, not necessarily urban communities, but certainly in suburban and rural communities, around, you know, sort of the despair that we've seen in terms of white men, and their concern with losing power. And so there's like a mirror going on here in the Black community as well, though the Black community has been differently situated than the white, you know, sort of rural or suburban community as well.
Absolutely. And speaking to that very briefly, like, one of the things that I try and speak to in the book, because again, although I hope that this resonates deeply with, you know, Black readers for sure, it is also an appeal to, you know, many of those white working class voters in demonstrating how the ideology of white supremacy, you know, has impacted them a great deal as well. As you know, again, our idea of white is a really, really new and fresh concept. It was done and created specifically to harness political power and to determine who gets what and who does not. So Irish, Italian folks, Jewish folks were highly discriminated against when they arrived here. But it was easier to, like, you know, become white over time. And people wanted to become white because there was great political and economic tangible outcomes in being able to, like, you know, fall into that category. So I try and really historically unpack how this is utilized as a way to try and almost kind of do a bait and switch for many white voters, where the political power and gains that, you know, many of these communities, you know, would want and desire, I think has been thwarted by clinging to this notion, this false and nostalgic and imagined notion of whiteness, which just is not in line with how our country has developed historically. I apologize for interrupting your question.
Oh, no, no, that was exactly sort of where I wanted you to sort of take your discussion and the research. And a lot of what you are also doing in the book is pulling in examples from popular culture venues of you know, how we're sort of seeing some of these cleavages and this idea of Black power or disempowerment, or, you know, again, the kind of writing off of an entire but really important community to the Democratic Party. And I know you have particular research interest in popular culture. So how did popular culture inform the work that you did in this book, and what did you learn from it?
Oh, great question. So in some ways, this has been building, particularly some of those gender divides where in previous work, I looked at this pretty explicitly in terms of how some of the patriarchy, so a lot of my work is focused on hip hop culture. And for listeners out there, this is expanded beyond just rap music, although a lot of my research does focus on the content in rap lyrics. And in those, historically, a lot of times my research has found that there has been some patriarchal and sexist language used. So, for example, one of the ways that men will put down other men within hip hop spaces sometimes is to kind of almost feminize them. Pull your skirt up, dude. Things of that nature, or to call, somebody the B word, for example, will be a way to emasculate them. So those kind of things have been endemic to our culture for quite some time. Some of my discussion with my friends in terms of their latent, sometimes overt homophobia has been related to kind of the culture itself, where I'll hear things like, oh, my God, I'm watching TV and I'm listening to music. And they're trying to shove this homosexual stuff down our throats, which is, empirically false. There have been many studies in terms of content analysis that look at the proportion of gay characters and people that can be, open in other platforms within our culture. And there have been some inroads for sure, but it's still not nearly representative. A lot of times when it is, it's done in a very superficial type way. The same way I'm just because the NFL is having every lift every voice and sing the informal national Black anthem after the national anthem of the United States, this don't mean that the NFL gives a damn about Black folks. They care about Black dollars. So the same way some of these corporations, they'll appeal to different communities, but they're not really taking any hard stands towards uplifting Latino folks, uplifting LGBTQ folks, uplifting the Black community. But people will see these things in the culture. So they're like, oh, my God, Black stuff is everywhere. It's the popular music. I'm seeing all these different TV shows. That's very different from actual power. So it is cool that we see a few more Black folks in a TV show. It's dope that, Morgan Freeman gets to play president sometime in some movies. That's very different from actual power. But a lot of times our political understandings come from our TV shows, the movies that we watch, and it doesn't allow for a really complex understanding of how these issues are shaped and distributed. So popular culture is, I think, really important to really begin to push back against some of these false narratives and do it in a way that is less superficial than I think that we see a lot of times.
And so I did want to bring you back to the real emphasis in the book itself, which is that the gains that Black people have achieved in politics, in power, in the United States, have been often obscured, overlooked, dismissed, not trumpeted. And again, this is in tension with obviously the unpleasant narratives that have been so embedded about Black citizens. And so you go to great lengths to talk about, what has been achieved by essentially Black power. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, sort of how you're tracing and what you're tracing and sort of showing that in this book?
No, thank you for asking that. For example, in talking like, you know, to some of my, you know, friends that like inspire, like, you know, this book, there will be an argument, for example, and this is not uncommon within the Black community, that Obama didn't do anything for Black people. Like, you know, he only like, you know, focused on like, you know, gays and lesbians. And this would be through like, you know, supporting like, you know, marriage rights and, you know, just, you know, being treated equally and things of that nature, which are basic fundamental things. And as one who's been married before and hope to be married again pretty soon. So hopefully, you know, the potential, the future missus isn't listening here, but getting the right to be married, man, like that's not like, you know, in some cases that could be more of a punishment than a right or a reward. I say that jokingly, but, you know, those are the kind of like tangible, like really headline worthy type gains that a lot of times we use as a shorthand understanding of our political system. So I, you know, really labor to get, you know, really in the weeds in terms of like just some of the everyday granular things that have been achieved, which are not always sexy, won't be make for like, you know, good headlines on Fox, CNN or MSNBC, but are really critically important, particularly for my generation, Lily, where so many of the things that were fought for in the 1950s and 60s were not recognized, were not realized by the people who were fighting for them. I live in a very flawed America, no question about it. It is not the America that my parents and grandparents lived in by any means. And that's really important to understand. And those things can just happen magically. So I go like, you know, really detailed into like, you know, different policy gains, going back to the 1800s, and to also look at how those things were achieved. The Black voting bloc is not large enough where we can ever do these things on our own. So we're going to need to have, like, by definition, we have to exist through coalition politics. And through that, through Reconstruction, through the New Deal, through the Great Society, and even in the Obama and Clinton years, there have been some really tangible gains that have been had, you know, whether it be things like that, like, so Obama and others have not passed any kind of overt, this is a policy for, like, you know, Black people. But Obamacare, for example, housing relief that folks were provided, the student debt relief that's being fought for now, those are issues that disproportionately impact, you know, Black folks. Particularly, again, in the underclass. So throughout history, we've only had a few cases. So in the Great Society, for example, there, and actually, let me take this back, because I was about to speak to during the Great Society and legislation during the 1960s, there were laws that were like, you know, for Black folks, but that's not even true. The civil rights laws benefited a whole swath of people. It was very deliberate in the language. That may not, like, you know, again, be demonstrated in a PBS special or your social media meme, but the reality is that those gains, like, you know, really benefited everyone. And I think that holds true throughout Reconstruction. Many efforts in the late 1800s and the early 20th century, for example, to mobilize rights for labor across race. And throughout history, politicians have used the seductive methods of white supremacy to kind of upset some of those coalitions and left many Black voters sometimes to feel like that we're left to fight alone. But the book is makes very strong efforts to go through roughly 150 years of history and showing the gains and showing how, again, some things that were fought for in the 1920s, we found that we got to fight for again in the 1970s. There are things much like, again, it was believed that Roe versus Wade, like, okay, we did it. Like, no. You got to keep fighting, because one of the things that I want folks to know is that the people on the other side that want to fight against social progress, they never stop. And there are always people, like, you know, laboring to push that back. So we have to stay informed. We got to stay mobilized. But the notion that there haven't been real, actual, tangible gains to improve people's lives in very direct ways is just patently false.
And so in terms of the, you know, sort of the the thrust of the book in its sociological dimensions, as opposed to some of the political sciencey dimensions, is that you are looking at, you know, the sort of particular sense or feeling that particularly Black men have had, and that we're seeing some of this reflected in polling of late. And you talk about this also with regard to the 2016 election, particularly with regard to, you know, the Black coalitions in places like Milwaukee, or Philadelphia, where the turnout was not nearly as high as when Obama was on the ticket, in 2008 and 2012. But that, you know, we've had like, you know, two steps forward, one step back in terms of this coalition, but that Black men are really not necessarily on the same plane as the Black women, with regard to the Democratic Party. But are they politically engaged in general, or are they more stepping back in general?
Great question. In my research, there does seem to be more of a stepping back overall, but for those that are engaged, there are more and more folks that are being, more and more Black males that are being peeled off by, I was going to say conservative politics, but I mean, quite frankly, and, you know, no offense to any of your listeners, which I hope is a bipartisan group. I was going to say conservative politics, but that's not really what this is in terms of the modern Republican Party. It's a very radicalized, you know, notion based upon, again, our historical political playing. And I think, again, just the overt, very simplistic, quite frankly, like, you know, level of machismo and patriarchy, I think that that's really appealing. So the fear is that, you know, that, you know, issues like, you know, again, LGBTQ, the gun rights laws, where like I've heard from folks like, because again, there was a very strong gun rights faction within the Black male community. And I understood, I am not a gun owner, but I enthusiastically support, you know, Black folks' rights to own a gun. Too often, the folks that have been, you know, paid through our tax dollars to serve and protect us have not always done it at the levels that, you know, have been satisfactory. So I totally understand, you know, the desire to, you know, bear arms, you know, for sure. Now, I don't know if you need a damn AR-15, like, you know, a war zone weapon to, like, you know, be able to do that. But I understand the temptation. So I've heard from some of my friends, the Democrats are trying to steal my guns. No, they are not. Like, so I think that part of the problem, we need to be more informed and engaged, you know, because, again, in these conversations, I try and challenge, you know, some of my Black male friends, like, look, and I'm very mindful. I'm not even trying to change your mind or your policies per se. But if you say that you have these certain values, the politicians that you're talking about supporting are not really aligned with those. And I think that given the advent of social media, that's, you know, we're seeing some fallout there. I've even sent some of my, you know, folks in these conversations, Lily, on social media, there have been really targeted attempts aimed at Black men specifically to try and, like, you know, again, propagandize some of these issues and to simplify them. And in many cases, been very effective. So I think that a lot of these messages, unfortunately, you know, have kind of an organic appeal to Black males. But I think a large part of this is related to a dearth of information. And in this way, a final point to this, where I definitely want citizens to be more informed, but part of it, a large part of this is the media's fault, quite frankly. And I say this, one who has a very proud background in journalism, but the way that we talk about, you know, stories, particularly in the broadcast media, I think our print media still does a good job of this, quite frankly, but our broadcast media, it just provides really simplified, dumbed down, you know, frames of some of these issues. It doesn't dig into the things that, like, you know, happen every day. You turn on the news every day and it gives you these, it's either Trump indictment or now again, Palestine, Israel, And you have, we're going to talk to all the people who feel like, okay, that Israel's being heavy-handed. We're going to talk to this group that feels like, no, they have rights to defend themselves. And there's not even complexity given to an issue like that, which again, as you know, it just has so many different layers and tentacles to it. But we just get this really simplified version. And that's really served out democracy very poorly. It's called the media is called the fourth estate for a reason, because to have a functioning democracy, you need to have an informed public. And the education that you spoke to, where there's not as many men being recruited into formal education, because again, I am not saying this from a soapbox. I live a very privileged life that gives me access to all types of information and that forces and challenges me to be informed about these things. So, and even for me, it is hard to keep up with everything. But I think that our media and our politicians have to find a way to penetrate through these messages, because the prejudices that they're experiencing and expressing, like, it's not unique or new to Black men. But I do think that our ranks are being targeted in some very specific ways. But we have to do it. And these have not been easy conversations. When we're hearing these things, the same way that I've told some of my white colleagues that if you want to be an ally to the Black community, it's not just enough to, like, post on social media. When your uncle, your granddaddy is saying some crazy stuff at Thanksgiving dinner, I'm not telling you to, like, pick a fighter not to love your grandfather. I love some of the closed-minded people in my life, but I think that we do need to do a more effective job of kind of correcting some of these narratives and at least widening out the discussion. So I really try to do that in conversations that I have with folks, because, like, it is really, and I guess maybe I'm more sensitive to it now, that after having written this book, it's really omnipresent in a barbershop, sports talk, and different sporting events, within the music that I listen to, that some of these things are just really circulated without a lot of thought. So we all have a responsibility to challenge these things a lot more, but also in a way where we're not canceling folks and we're not, like, pushing them away from discussion. We need to have true dialogue and become more effective in sharing information.
And so that is the solution that you're talking about, because you do talk about the fact that you're promising some suggestions on how to get out of potentially this quagmire, at least how the Democratic Party, because the Republican Party has also been, consciously to a point, making an appeal to Black Americans, because Black Americans tend to be more conservative than liberal. I've been reading think pieces for 40 years about how the Republican Party is more the natural home for Black voters than the Democratic Party is. But at the same time, obviously there are these questions about, sort of what's perhaps a little bit racialized in the Republican Party. So what are some of the solutions besides, sort of having the opportunity with people who are perhaps spouting closed-minded perspectives?
No, that is a great point. And you're right. Like, so the Black community, and this has long been true, has been, again, we don't want to paint with a broad brush, but I think you're right. Like, it is a very socially conservative space at times. And I think that those messages can have some appeal to Black folks. No question about it. The solutions are, again, more information. And then the more broad one is that Democratic politicians have to, again, the same way that Republican politicians, they have made no bones about standing with the military families, for example, or standing with evangelicals very strongly and unapologetically. The Democrats have to be, Democratic politicians have to begin to do that more. And again, I see some shifts in this regard, but there have been times, where, from the Sister Soldier moment on, where Bill Clinton in trying to appeal to white voters wanted to be able to demonstrate that, hey, I can stand up to my base. Obama even had to, kind of do this delicate dance at times, but one of the more disappointing times during his presidency was when he was lecturing to Black fathers and things of that nature in a way that came off very condescending and like almost like typical of the kind of things that we've been used to hearing from white politicians. So Democrats have to become more effective in terms of how they communicate to these communities. And let's be clear, we're not talking about pandering because Black people are going to see right through that. Like we know, like when you're coming to this church and you haven't been anywhere near a Black community in 4 years, like people know what's going on there. So we have to consistently show up. Democratic politicians have to consistently show up, not just when the cameras are rolling. And they have to become more overt in identifying policies that are specific to the Black community. And do it in a way where it shows that, hey, the gains for this group does not mean like, that you have to lose anything. I forget the official. I'm assuming that you attended the DACA event on Tuesday. Okay, so there were some concerning things that were said there in terms of like, the Republican official talked about building a wall, which is just like, symbolically stupid on his face, but it's just bad policy. If you understand anything about illegal immigration, ain't nobody climbing a wall, dude. Like you pay somebody that like, has to drive back and forth. You pay them good enough. They will ship people in. You get all types of underground tunnels. And as so long as there's work here for corporations to give them, people are going to flood, into the country. But that's a whole nother discussion. But there were points he was speaking about a bipartisan bill, and he talked about again how like it's a policy that can appeal to both progressive and conservatives. So I think that there are ways for politicians for both parties, quite frankly, to thread those needles a lot more effectively than they do. The challenge for politicians, and I will acknowledge this, I don't have any easy answers for this part, Lily. Both parties are very polarized right now. And it is very difficult to like, I don't want to say moderate positions, but in some cases, trying to like, find ideas that can appeal to a broad range, that's becoming more challenging to do. So I think that we have to begin to find, areas where we have common ground in terms of our politics. But there have been, but there needs to be some times where Democratic politicians are not afraid to say like, yes, we stand with Black, and again, not just during George Floyd moments and giving speeches and hashtags, but really showing like that you're committed to, that you acknowledge there are some still systemic disparities between Black Americans and other groups, and really take some deliberate actions towards making those things happen. So, because the book also is a warning to the Democratic Party that if they don't begin to do that, they're going to lose more of like Black voters to the Republicans, or worse yet, they're going to be more and more people that sit out. So there needs to be some more tangible gains and deliverables for the Black community as well. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to do that in a way that does not compromise other groups, but that's going to require the political balance of folks more talented than myself, the political dexterity of folks more talented than myself to be able to deliver that message effectively.
And so now that you've solved, race relations in the United States.
Is that what I'm doing?
What are you working on now, Kareem?
I may have called some more, but I'm trying. But I'm sorry, did we freeze?
What are you working on now?
Yes, so I am finishing up, so the Marvel, MCU, Marvel Comic Universe, which again, it really reinforces just how our politics are intertwined in popular culture. And I'll admit, when Black Panther came out, that was something that was viewed as like, hugely political within the Black community, not just seen as like a movie in and of itself. I think people almost saw like a responsibility to go see it almost as a show of like, racial solidarity, if you will. But as I started to dig into it more with your assistance, I really was impressed at just how intersected with politics, the entire MCU is. So my particular focus right now, I'm contributing a chapter to the latest edition of this book that speaks to some of the cleavages that you spoke about earlier, the divide between Black men and women within our political sphere, And I juxtaposed that narrative into how the Black Panther series played out, particularly the last one where, you know, again, with T'Challa, you know, Chadwick Boseman's death, and then T'Challa, you know, being killed off in the film, and how in some circles, even that just generated a large amount of like consternation within some Black male circles. We saw this, for example, not to have too much of a diversion, but the Woman King, I don't know if you've seen the Viola Davis film. So they were like, you know, Black dudes online and were kind of freaking about that as well. So just showing again how this female power dynamic, because again, in the second film, the female protagonists were the heroines and the ones that saved the day. And they demonstrated like both intellectual and physical power in a way that I thought was really impressive. It is, you know, customary Black women, quite frankly, but just we haven't seen those kind of images historically within Hollywood. So I try and explore the way that the film kind of like is almost art imitating life in terms of this struggle between like, you know, Black male dominance and Black female dominance. But my argument here is that all of these things can work in alignment. And that whether they want to or not, Black dudes like myself are going to have to get comfortable because a progressive society and a progressive world requires more more female power more broadly, but certainly more Black female power. And quite frankly, both in my book and in that chapter, Lily, I argue that essentially Black women have to save the world, much like they did in the Black Panther 2.
Well, you know, again, another responsibility for Black women to take up.
Absolutely. Right. Black women out there, I know you all don't have anything else to do. So, you know, what's one more task? But yeah, it is. And I don't take that lightly because it is a lot. Like it is a challenge being a Black man in America, even for someone of my state in life. It can be a challenge being a Black man in America, but it is just like horrific at times to imagine kind of the challenges that Black women have to go through day to day. But I think that that position and that social posture historically also makes them uniquely suited to be able to empathize with the struggles across communities in a way that I see lacking sometimes amongst other factions.
And so we give them the power and we know that they have the power, but I feel like it's something else on the Black woman's to-do list.
No question.
And
as a final point with that, I also like make note of how like Shuri, right?
Shuri, yeah.
Shuri. So how Shuri and Killmonger, for example, so Killmonger in many ways almost wanted power for power's sake, where Shuri wanted to have power that was going to actually benefit, you know, the wider community. So even there, like she could have abused her power, and we'll see what the next, installment holds. But she even like kind of like, you know, hey, I've done my part to stabilize our society. Now I don't really want to hang on to power because titular power, and as I'm sure you know, and you know, having served as a chair at FEC president amongst other capacity in other roles, hell, it's a huge responsibility and a very thankless job. So I don't think that, like, you know, Black women are using this in a way to like try and dominate others, but to actually try and like, you know, make society better. And I don't pretend that that's because there's something genetically within women. I believe that Black women's experience in America has given them a unique perspective to be able to execute power in that way.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And I do think that, again, it's a politically powerful group that, you know, has often been behind the scenes as opposed to in front, which is often the case with women, but particularly with Black women as well. So I would like to thank Kareem Muhammad for joining me today to talk about the fight for Black empowerment in the USA, America's Last Hope. This was published in 2024 by Rutledge Press in their Research in Race and Ethnicity series. Kareem, is there a brick and mortar store with possibly an online presence that you would like to give a shout out to?
We are working on brick and mortar. My publishers probably have a better sense of that information than I do. So I apologize. Offhand, I'm not sure, but I will make you aware as I become privy to that information. I apologize at the end of the semester. As important as I think this book is, there have been so many other, you know, pins that I'm juggling right now, but I'll have that information for you and your listeners soon for sure.
I appreciate that, but I'm sure people can buy it at Routledge's website.
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
All right. Thank you, Kareem, for joining me today to talk about this book.
No, thank you so much for having me. And again, you know, I appreciate all the work that you're doing to try and spread these messages more broadly. And it was a great pleasure talking with you today.